important thing is this blue section is where we're at. This is the immediate focus. Right? We didn't do CIA interrogation manual last week, but we're going to pick that up first this week before we start talking about group stuff. Then we're going to do this. Who's doing second half persuasion? And then next week is this. We watch the persuaders, which you can see online. You can see there's three copies I put in the whatever room that's called, the equipment room. And it's going to be the Monday night movie this coming Monday. And you're also going to read this as best you can. It looks fun, but it's really not. I mean, it's a big screen. It's not crazy. Read it as best you can. Try to get what's being said there. Next week, for the first hour, there's a guy coming. I don't know, it's weird, because I think of them as one of the big evil companies. The company that invented something that you're going to see in the Persuaders movie. Let's see if I can even find it. There's a tool. This tool. We're slow today, aren't we? Are we? Oh, we don't have the right. Oh, come on. Does this not have? This has players, right?
Yeah, but I don't know about real audio. Is there a real?
Anyway, there's this tool that actually you can see is in this picture, where they give a test sample. They give them a little thing with a dial, and then as you watch a movie or a commercial, you're supposed to register whether you kind of like the thought of your person or dislike it, and it draws these lines. Like there'll be like, you know, a red line for women and a green line for men, and then that's the way they judge whether they're moment-to-moment way, whether they're persuading you properly. Well, the company that makes that dial saw the syllabus for the class on my blog and asked if they could come and show us that thing. So I was like, sure. So first I think that they're doing it because they don't want you all, you know, the 20 people who might be important someday, to get the wrong idea about their technology. But they, again, like all the people in this movie, they liked the way they were portrayed in the movie. They said it got them a ton of business, and this was partly their way of thanking me. So then, all right, I figured this super sophisticated, whatever. They're out in Portland. The guy who's coming is called twice. The first time he called me, he asked, he said, the address I gave him said New York, New York. But he thought that NYU was in Manhattan. So I told him, yeah, the school's in Manhattan, but it's one of the boroughs of New York. And then he called last time because he was making his airplane reservation, and none of the airports are in Manhattan. And then
he's the guy that made the technology?
No,
he's
the
guy. He administers it, whatever. He goes around with this kit when they do a
apparently
test.
Not very
but
far.
I guess he's normally going to, I don't know,
where do they?
Dallas or Houston or
Peoria.
Arkansas, who knows where. Yeah, he goes to corporate office parks, wherever they send him. You know, he asked if there's a Courtyard Marriott in Manhattan. I don't think there is.
There's a Marriott.
Marriott Marquis. But the Courtyard Marriott, you need room for a courtyard. Yeah. Like that. It's in Manhattan. There's nothing like that here. But I think what happens is they send him out to an airport hotel, and then he goes into the kit and hooks up to stuff. So he's going to come at 12. Are any of our people equipment room type people, or equipment people, or GAs, or anything in our class? Because he's got a plug in somehow. Are you free at noon?
Yeah.
And then I'm going to be here. I just don't know if I can help him.
All right, yeah. I'll
help
him.
And I got to ask, they need two monitors. One that we watch, and then one that has the thing happen on it. So we can kind of break up the room into halves, and we can watch So happening. I thought the fun thing to do would be to take, just because I feel meta on everything, that the thing that we should judge, why don't we take the section of the documentary that shows their technology? And then we'll watch that and then register whether we're approving of the technology or disapproving of the technology using the technology. And then we'll see. Why not? If nothing else, that, when you read something about the neurolinguistic programming in here last week, that should send him just to break his brain open. Can technology be used to
We should copy exactly what's going on the screen, like try to follow the line exactly. That might trick him out.
Yep.
We like it as much as everybody else likes it.
So next week, be sure to watch The Persuaders, because this guy's coming in as a result of it. That's a 90-minute documentary in its TV form. And then this little bit of reading. We're normal. We meet every week, even though there's a Monday that doesn't happen.
Yeah.
And then there's... The Wednesday happens, though.
I think the Wednesday does happen.
Does it? Was it Wednesday?
That's probably the whole week off or something weird like that.
No, it doesn't.
Really? That'd be awesome.
It doesn't. This one doesn't. That would be the 23rd. We're not here. All right.
I think somebody told me that we have a fall break. That's
no,
break.
I think what happens Wednesday is you do Monday.
Oh.
What?
Why would...
Usually you do five.
You don't.
What?
There's a Monday that's off.
Thursday.
Next Monday. No, the Monday after next Monday.
Yes, October 10th.
Is off. And then you make up that Monday
on
Wednesday before Thanksgiving.
So what happens to the Wednesday before Thanksgiving?
It doesn't have to because we started classes on Tuesday, so Tuesday, Wednesday have an extra class on Monday anyway.
Then so Tuesday.
First week class was Tuesday.
Tuesday.
We don't have to have some
Monday.
Yeah.
Have Monday classes.
Yeah.
What Monday do we have off? Just a random Monday.
It's like I think it's like Columbus Day or something.
That's not a holiday anymore.
Arbor Day.
Veterans Day.
It's Hallmark Day.
It's probably Veterans Day.
Yeah.
No, I think it's Columbus Day.
We didn't have off last year.
Oh yeah.
Alright, I'll figure that out later. Someone's not here. Who are you? Who's not here? Just admit it.
Ariel? Oh, I'm here. Darn.
Snitch.
How are you?
Ariel's not here.
Flagger.
So then what I want to do is we're going to start with this just to make up our time. Let's start with State Interrogation Manual. Then I want to talk a little bit about the difference between... I just want to kind of catch us up to where we are and explain why we've done what we've done up to this week, including next week, and then where it goes from there. Just sort of recap. And then we can get into our own discussion on second half of coercion and then wait, then come back and do the group experiences of sort of group coercion stuff. So I'm gonna call this up so he's there. I hope you did have a chance to look through some of this thing. It's kind of a remarkable document. On some level, it seemed to me very non-threatening, but then sometimes it's starting to feel very threatening.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, there's just this. It seems so incredibly basic, and then you question whether it could actually work. Tactics have to be reduced down to such simple things as like leaving a door slightly open so that maybe there's somebody dropping or hearing, the next room over, and that kind of gameplay. Just in as the, and under the topic that we're kind of thinking about of technologies of persuasion, which is really minimal technology, so we're just trying to manipulate the slightest things, slightly.
what technology, like what? Like a light bulb, leaving a light bulb on 24 hours a day for a week. Apparently that affects people.
Yeah, you could get like any, like the slightest piece of it, but if it's in your control, like something that's in, like someone else's control, and how would it be the other person's, like, that's the tool, and that's all it takes. Minimalist, room, manipulation, and so on. I was trying to think of things that were related to it, like one of these stories last week, and the closest thing I had, I think, is maybe like a job. Interrogations and tactics where, especially if it's on a corporate level, you're taken into like the kind of generic type room, and you've got the person that first greets you, it's like, oh, you want a water here, so like cafeteria, that go ahead and drink. Then we'll put you in this conference room, it's going to be this room, and empty, and you're waiting for the next room. But then maybe you had that kind of.
And have you had jobs and stuff?
I've had jobs.
I mean, so if the person comes and they're, you know, whatever, the human resources assistant person,
yeah,
like, and they say, here's the cafeteria, and it's like empty, I suppose, at that point, take a drink, does then, do you wonder, and are they watching me take this drink, do they wonder what drink I'm taking, if I use a giant cup, do they think I'm greedy, if I use a small cup, do they think I'm...
Yeah, well, it's the thing, there's such generic spaces, like, I don't remember it, going and interviewing at Oracle, and that's what it was like. It was like, you know, the weird fridge that had like two or three kinds of drinks, like just all coffees. So yeah, what do you pick? And then you're at the table, and that's kind of your identity. Yeah. The table, like, empty room, and there's a drink that I chose.
And where do you even put the thing if you have the drink? If you're sitting at the table, and you, I mean, this is a great book by Michael Korda called Power, which is all about this little corporate games. It's like, if you come to a meeting and you know, start taking up a lot of space on the table, then there's a certain power thing about that, right? I mean, what does that say?
That's right.
I got out of school, and I was looking for a job, and I had a group of some of our clinical skills we call Not One Day, which is all about different interviewer and interviewee tactics. Where it's like, knock them dead. It's like, you know, the interviewer that talks only about themselves, the interviewer that doesn't ask you any questions, you know, and all these different profiles for the kind of interviewer that you may come into contact with, and then what you should do, you know, if that happens. So.
Did they give you a little script sheet?
I think they were more like little mock.
Responses.
Yeah, little like canned responses, like you can say something like.
Yeah.
Knock them
but
dead.
This obviously is worse, right? Than a job interview.
Yeah.
I mean, because it lasts days and
oh, yeah.
They hit you and stuff.
I may be the only one that was meant to notice, but I didn't realize that like interrogators could laugh. Like I was shocked.
Even
to
cops
find
show
out.
That a lot.
Yeah, I was shocked to find that out. My friend is a public defender, and we were talking about it one day, and I couldn't get over it. I couldn't imagine that they could laugh.
The fact is, I mean, every lawyer has always told me this. If you're ever arrested, really, really say nothing. There's no logic. There's no logic by which you should speak, even if you've done nothing. There's really no logic by which you should speak. They'll come at you and say, well, if you tell us what you know, then we'll know that you're not involved.
Right.
Sorry, I can't, because you guys abuse this privilege too much.
You say you need a lawyer. Just tell them you need a lawyer. I can't speak without your lawyer.
But, I mean, you would have to be privy to that kind of knowledge. I mean, like, think about, you know, a foreigner or someone
who's not
from
this country.
Yeah.
You
they
understand
tell
your
you.
Rights.
Yeah.
I didn't even explain to you.
I mean, you know.
Good. Tell us what happened.
Yeah,
pay
no
attention
know.
To that.
No.
What if you say no to that question? Can they proceed with...
I think they have to keep reading between
them. Do they have to change languages? Do they try in Spanish next and then just cycle through?
Huh? Rights?
What was that first part again?
Rights.
Defense?
Huh?
What do rights mean? Can you explain
that
as rights
to them?
Define that.
What about false confessions?
They're in here.
Yeah.
So that's a big problem, isn't it?
That's unbelievable.
Well, a lot of them, well, there's the whole... All right, break down for us the main stages. Remember them? They're kind of interesting. I mean, you start with what? We start by profiling the guy.
Screening, right?
Yeah.
And then, you just get the screening and just like getting to know the person, like kind of like that introductory thing you were just talking about, but it's the same kind of thing. It's like a conversation that's not necessarily about what you need information on, but it's about getting just some basics to get some kind of profile of the person.
Because CIA guys at least seem to think that getting a person's profile, one of those, what, nine types do they have?
They had nine types, and then they have a catch-all at the end, which I was kind of let down by that, because I was reading them, I was like, all right, I want to see which profile I'd wind up fitting into, and then at the end of eight distinct ones, it threw you a nine, which says, this is everyone else, or that has a possible
the exception.
Combination. The exception.
No, the average
on
one.
I felt like when I was reading it, like that entire fit was actually sort of geared towards coercing the interrogator. Because first of all, like the extent to which it kind of dehumanizes the subject. And then when I was reading through it, because like I kept reading every one, I was like, oh, that's me.
That's me.
And then I got to the last one, and it's like, oh, well, you may have all of these characteristics if you're the normal person. And then you're like, oh, thank God I'm the normal person. Now I can feel okay about interrogating all crazy bastards.
Yeah.
They used this on 24. I went to college with the guy who writes that show. And they used this when, you know, what's his name? He's always talking to someone on the cell phone, and he's like, I don't know, interrogate someone, and he's like, what, I'll take that, what? You know, and they're already researching, I don't know, I think it might be the sort of masochistic type. Okay, great. He's like, it worked. But, thank you for joining us.
No problem.
Thank you to the teachers who do that.
Thank God you're not one of them.
Yeah, I'm not, because I didn't mind that. We all made secret agreements on what we do to the next person we came to, and that's one of 10 things that's going to be done to you. Wait for the other. CIA interrogation day, sorry.
Where were you?
Your compatriots already confessed.
Yeah. Most of the information you got about the CIA in your book was taken
from this
from
very
here,
thing.
This one. Not from like personnel investigations.
No, just this document. This document wasn't online back then. This was I forgot who got it. Smoking Gun or someone got it from Freedom of Information Act, just around that time. And no, the thing that was new was when I took it and did a side-by-side comparison of this with the Toyota Corporation 1970-something sales manual. I was like, oh, this is fucked up. You know, because it was like the same techniques, just slightly changed. So if you have someone, you know, in here you have, because there's someone walking the hall with a clipboard saying, oh, yes, we've got number 3's confession. You know, and in the Toyota book it says, oh, send someone to the hall saying, oh, we've sold that one that the person wants, and we've got another offer on it now. So either those guys had the book or were X, you know.
What do you think was line, when it says lines to read it, is that something that you would think was much more like secret or juicy or just?
Well, this one I would guess was racist. A lot of times it seems to they'll talk about distinctive culture.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like right after that, it's like, so if it's a Jew, tell him you got his money. If he's black, there's like lines to read. Sometimes I think it's bad stuff, you know, or it's the more coercive. I mean, this is a non-coercive manual, right? I mean, so that means the coercive manual, the one that's like takes splinters and shove it under their fingernails, or I mean. I interviewed a guy once who was trained by the CIA in Texas, And one of the interrogation techniques he had learned was, you know, you take a spoon and pop someone's eye out, so it's hanging down on the, and they see, straight down, and he's like, pop the eye out, they come back right away. Pop, just pop the eye. Apparently, yeah, I mean, you can do permanent damage to the eye also.
Apparently.
Wow. That's American, I mean, that's in our book, sorry, because we trained the, what was it, Salvador, we were training those guys.
That's School of Americas, right?
Yeah.
Which still exists.
Pop the eye out. Pop the eye.
Once you get into practice of that, you're less likely to
get it. I guess, I don't know if that's what they're worried about.
Once you master that thing, because the only way to get
some special.
But identifying your source, I mean, this is something that every salesperson is doing, right? Every car salesperson. This is something that every telemarketer, in theory, is doing before they call you. They know how you responded the time before. So, you know, sizing up is something that just drop the cap. See if I can. It's something that you see throughout. You know, even in the most informal kinds of hand-to-hand coercion. What do they do after that?
They want it to be to planning. So you want to like set wherever it is that you're going to go, wherever you want to make sure that you've got everything set the way you can get it. The room should be this way. Make sure that nobody's going to be walking through there, that they can't be anywhere on the other side, and then any distractions, just like planning and coming up with control of the environment.
As much as you can, yeah. I mean, that makes sense in every environment. You know, from there right onto the web, you don't want to have an extremely coercive website and then someone else's banner ad with a bouncing monkey on top of it. So, wait a minute. Kind of breaks the flow. And then what?
That's it's cool. They're setting the stage. Maybe planning and setting the stage are kind of the same thing. I'm not sure. Planning and setting the stage. That just goes into the actual employee techniques.
Setting the stage, I think, would be different. I mean, particularly when you look at I have the sort of section on Farrakhan and the Promise Keepers and all that. And setting the stage is more sort of like Hitler telling everyone, we've all come here from all different parts. And it's before you're actually going to do your interrogation or induction. I think setting the stage, you can actually be talking to the person at that point.
Oh, that's right. That's how you kind of lead the person, and maybe not necessarily. That's when they talk about some of the lines of questioning.
Yeah.
I thought one of the interesting things in it too, there was just the need for people to finish whatever they started and got into. Kind of like what you were saying, how well, if you just say nothing, you say nothing and you've got not invested in yourself in it at all, if you're going to be interrogated. Same on the topic, whether it's a car salesman or whatever, but just there's something where if you can be brought to like a certain level, even if it's wrong. Finish off and go out there. And that's where you get with these false confessions, or you get just some voluntary information from this, like, works with like a purchase or whatever. But just a good guy.
This ache for conclusion.
Yeah, yeah. That becomes the thing. Even when it's information that you know you want to give, for some reason, the urge to just finish it.
Well, I mean, in some sense, it's a suicide urge. You know, when the existential crisis of life is just too big, you know, people kill themselves, apparently it's in order to exert control. It's not because they've lost control. I'm going to end it, you know. That's kind of what I guess you hope for on a certain level, unless they're ending it just to end it and don't really know anything. Then you're kind of fucked. The funnest part in here was all those
the profile things, so techniques.
The names. Spinoza and Mortimer. Which I could never figure out why Spinoza and Mortimer was called Spinoza and Mortimer.
It was Mortimer Smerd.
Was it Mortimer Smerd, was it?
Yeah, here's someone that's going next door, or Nobody Loves You, News from Home.
Ventriloquist.
Survivor does the news from home, right? Like, I just like 8 weeks into the show and everybody's like exhausted. Then they try to compete for like watching videos
of their loved ones. Yeah, no, I remember.
I'm not on live set.
Oh, you're not?
Mommy turns the set up at 9. So I can't stand it. Yeah. So I had a reality television overload or something.
The
one guy who won that one time faced
the
death.
Yes, he
did.
He didn't win.
To get sympathy?
To
win the sympathy.
Yeah, he didn't win, but yeah, he faked the death of his grandmother. And there was one show where family members came, and you know, instead of the videos, the family members actually came, and his best friend came, who was also in on it, and announced like during that time that his sick grandmother had died. And everybody was exhausted and tired and happy to see their loved ones and so sad for him because his grandmother died. He comes to a big show about being sad and sad. It was awful.
It's great. I love that. It's a fucking game, you know? Play the fucking game.
I mean, it was great. It was awful, but...
Didn't he say, like, where's grandma?
I don't
remember. It was something like that. Just,
well, the real question was, did CBS set him up, though, or did he come up? Did CBS like set him up? Did the producers go like?
Maybe they
did. Here's my question: was there anything that came up for you as you were reading it that you wanted to bring up to these people, or that you want some closure about?
I was just looking for any other experience you've had or anything. I just went a little bit into last week, but maybe more directly, obviously, interrogation.
Where someone was doing something beyond what's really just happening. In other words, someone was using.
Yeah, where you really felt like you didn't have, because in most of these instances, like the, well, car sales is a little bit different, but it's similar to car sales, where you've lost control over the environment. So the environment is the technology, and it's not even that control. It's kind of like a sort of minimalist thing that works. But I just think it's, that was the thing that struck me, reading it, and you kept me wanting to find more, like find something that had more leverage somewhere to resolve.
Yeah. I mean, I've had to deal with cops sometimes. You realize with them, I mean, they're using techniques and stuff, but with a lot of them, there's a really intense need to dominate and for them to know that they're in the dominant position. But if you roll over too quickly, then they get frustrated that you're just, that you know what they, so it's really... It's interesting with cops. You have to act as if you have the capability of resisting their domination, but you're surrendering it because they are imposing and frightening. Do you know what I mean? Especially like Jersey cops.
Can you just say your
silver glasses and hats and things? Well, I've had cops just yell at me. It's like, just, you know, either give me a ticket or what? And they yell at me about weird shit.
If you point out how intimidating they are, do you think they'd let you off? Like, well, thank you. Like, you're super intimidating. Like, I'd be like,
you can't just do that. They know.
You
have to play the game. But you
can't
say
it real angrily.
You can't play it in a way that lets them know that you know you're playing the game or it's not real and they've got to go to the next step. I mean, that's how all this weird violent shit happens. It's because the game is out of control for them. Yes, sir. I mean, you can go yes, sir. Or you can guess officer. You can go yes, sir, officer. You messing with me, boy?
You say yes, sir.
No, sir, yeah. Officer. No, no.
Yeah, sure.
What do you think about it? Because that's what they see. That's what they see.
There was a story I read in the paper recently about an undercover cop getting shot at a football tailgating party or something like that because he was trying to curb underage drinking and found some people who were drinking and they wouldn't do what he said, so he fired into the air. And another cop didn't know he was an underage cop and started shooting him. Cops
are not supposed to shoot their gun in the air.
Well,
he broke the rule.
Yeah, but he didn't. He wasn't known to be shot by the other guy, so he was shot himself. So that was the kind of
thing. You're only supposed to pull your gun if you're really going to shoot somebody. That's one of the cop rules.
Does anyone know about people just coming back down? Like if they
just stay up there.
Because they don't really.
No, they come down.
They come down, but the thing is, I always wondered like how come.
What are we asking? What are we talking
about? When they shoot a bullet in the head.
It's probably like a baseball and loses its velocity.
A bullet goes up, and I always wondered why people didn't die. And a bullet that doesn't hit anything doesn't change its shape either.
No, but just because it goes up really fast doesn't mean it comes down as fast. So if it comes
down
to 9.8,
yeah, but that's pretty fast.
Squared, accelerated.
Yeah.
And how far does a bullet go? Half a mile when you shoot it?
I mean, it's enough time to get into
people
like three. And it's shaped so that it will penetrate, right?
Yeah, but it probably flips over on its side.
In Palestine or wherever, Iraq, when they jump with their guns. Yeah.
Think about it.
Sorry. Before you die, I'm probably usually shoot straight up in the air.
I'm tired of slaying.
Yeah. The people in the next
What about Bob?
Yeah. Okay. I think he served his purpose. But I mean, all those little mind games, it's funny. I mean, they do seem like they're not really going to work. But I mean, good cop, bad cop. I mean, we all do that all the time. Whenever you do almost anything. It's even if, you know, there's two teachers who want something from Red. You know, we'll almost instinctively, as the conversation goes, one person will get the good cop role, the other person will get the bad cop role, and then you just broadside. You know, until she breaks. But it's a natural, it's almost natural at this point. I don't know whether it's because we're exposed to these things, or whether they just codify, you know, techniques we already use. But some of them do seem sort of nasty.
But subtle things really do work. I used to promote parties and go out and flyer people. And one thing I learned really quickly is if somebody rejects a flyer, the next five people behind them are going to reject it. But if somebody takes it, the next five, whoever sees that person taking it, they're going to get it. They're going to take it. It's just a subtle trigger. It's boom. It's okay. And so I just learned, if somebody doesn't take one, you just wait, let the next couple people pass, try again.
So
sometimes if you don't see it offered to the two people in front of you, they'll offer it to you and be like, oh, you must see something
special.
Don't say special.
Just be
you. Unfortunately, it's usually cards with naked women in it. I don't know. Why me?
Whatever happened to all the three card Monty teams?
Realize that guy is always around.
Totally.
7 months later. Whoa.
It's too windy nowadays.
Lucky guy.
You see that woman downstairs last week that was screaming that her t-shirt is funny? And then when you go to her t-shirt, she started screaming you want to look for her tits. And then she told you that, then she asked you if you want a flyer. And she tried to get a flyer to you by making you feel guilty that you're looking at her chest.
No, I was looking at her chest.
I saw her. I did.
Both looking at her chest. But
I saw her. She said, and then when I saw her, she said, any hot guy who shows me their chest, I'll give him Mardi Gras beads. And she had a bunch of Mardi Gras beads on.
I mean, did you get Mardi Gras beads?
For a comedy. It was for a comedy.
She was there on a mission. I think she was just.
No, I think she was part of a comedy.
So the entire thing was a performance, essentially.
I think so, yeah.
She was the flyer.
Literally.
To the big.
This is the only part that seemed really wrong. Other than, I wouldn't mind being so psychologically tortured and stuff. But the pain part, that kind of got to me. I mean, and this very Abu Jarrah, the idea of, you know, individuals told to stay in the tent for long periods, and that's, you know, what they were doing to those guys, making them stand on one leg for however long and breaking them down that way. But it is interesting that if you use pain after you've used other things, it looks like a sign of weakness, because you've tried all this shit and it hasn't worked. So if you're going to do pain, it sounds like you just got to start right off with it. Just, here you are in the room, okay, you know, here, bam, shake your hand. But it is tricky. It's like not to push. It's like even in sales and other things, if you push too hard, you get that negative effect. But still, even in an interrogation, in a so-called non-coercive, but psychologically manipulative interrogation, it's still seduction. You know what I mean? On one level or another, it's some kind of psychological seduction that the person will feel better about who they are and themselves and their family and reconnect with things that they've lost. You're still looking for what is the weakness in that person? What is the unresolved issue? How can I equate confession with satisfying that thing and thus get the confession? And all the other stuff is just different techniques to do that. In other words, which technique you use, Abbott and Costello, Linton Jeff, or, you know, Mortimer Smurd or whatever, is still just designed around that gap in the person, the thing that gives them to take the S training or join Scientology or do anything else that you're claiming or making them think that you've got the solution.
And I mean, that's the same as the engineering of consent, you know. That's, I mean, I guess that's what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's the same exact thing. You stimulate the inner desires and then you saturate them with a product. In this case, the product is all the different techniques that you're throwing out. But I mean, it seems like there's a thread of a really simple way to move people.
Well, that's not the...
That's what it comes down to, you know, in whatever field you're doing it in.
To what Kessu's saying, but in the idea that we all read this and this is all public information now, it is interesting that the handbook tends to go over like the walking out of the process as well, or like a backup, a safety, to say that in the event that you want to keep this person as an asset, or if you don't need them anymore, you don't want them going to the police or the courts. Like, it just seems very interesting because that an admonition of guilt. It's like saying, you know you've done something wrong, here's how you pad yourself to make sure that you can control someone so they don't report you, but at the same time, you know, here's evidence. You know, like, in a line of questioning, they would just ask you, did you follow this four-part process, yes or no? And then they would say yes, or I don't know, maybe I did, but like, did you use this phrase? Did you say these things? And it's all here, it's all listed. And then at the very end, it just, you know, stipulates, okay, now that you've done all this thing to someone, understand that, you know, walking them out of the progressive state is almost more important than anything else, because you are going to get in trouble. You could get in trouble, and it's very likely because they're going to remember this, and they're going to turn
right
on you.
And close and thank.
Yeah. Like, why?
It's the end of the Gap Act. It's the same thing. In other words, or at the end of the car thing, you know, when you say, are you happy with this deal? You know, if you get them to say, are you happy with this deal? Are you glad? You know, they can't come back at you in the same way.
What's the different purchase?
That's what?
Three different purchase.
I always thought the worst thing about the car dealerships is the cash back. It's like, wait, you're going to give us like $20,000 and we'll give you like $500 back. You know, it's,
well, but why do they do that with the phones? And the most returned kinds of appliances have these high rebates. I mean, why do a rebate instead of just having to be $50 cheaper? They do the rebate because that way they've bought your... not going to return this thing in 90 days. Like, I'm going to do it with my DVD to, or VCR to DVD recorder.
Well, it's also like data mining for a lot of them. Like, you have to give all your information over to them and like submit to their marketing agreement.
And rebates on low rate of being. Actually
used.
Yeah.
Right.
Especially all the electronics, like the rebates and stuff at Best Buy.
Yeah.
It's like 15%. People actually, they're
like,
I'm
going to
get $50 back, and if you never do it.
It's insane,
because
bucks.
Because
they got to,
like,
yeah,
but when
you
send between these
2 dates. I know,
they're
very cheap about
that. And when
there are all these phone ones that are actually sometimes impossible to get, because they have to be after something, but that, it's like,
it's just like 3 different people that you see.
Yeah.
And it has to be original.
Yeah.
You only have one.
They're clever. But once you've done that with the phone or something, you really, it's, I mean, to get you to lock into a contract, they'll do almost anything. It's you know, contractual stickiness. But I mean, the next time, I mean, Josh, have you ever tried to get out of a phone contract or cancel the phone thing? They put you on hold, they said they're going to get you a departure specialist or something, which is this person who has some really well-crafted computerized scripts on how to, it's a retention officer is what it is.
They have that for cable TV too.
It's really
like
great.
The dish TV.
It's really funny because I used to work at Dell, and they used to sell computers, and like, if you took
Boston?
Yeah, if you took longer than like, a call took longer than 20 minutes, your manager would get so pissed. But whenever people would get their computer and want to return it, I guarantee that person would be on the phone for at least 3 hours. So they would, so the deal closes in 20 minutes, but returning your computer takes 3 hours.
We do anything we can. Dell ended up sending all that overseas, unfortunately. They, I took a tour at the Red Rocks, what was that called? Red Rock?
Round Rock.
Round Rock campus. I mean, they had just like, fields of people, of customer service reps, pretty good high-tech diagnosis stuff. So you could dial into people's machines and all that, and they shipped it all to Bangalore.
They're actually shipping some of it back.
Finally, yeah, well, the business-to-business stuff, they're bringing.
Yeah, the higher-end stuff, they're, like, pulling back because it just wasn't working as well. It's like, they started using their Indian names because I used to ask them, I'd be like, where are you?
Yeah,
and like,
I just asked.
And then, and
dumb.
But then they realized it was
dumb.
Like, it was to-
really? Okay.
But they realized that it was just much easier to be honest and be like, okay, yeah I'm in call center and, you know.
Well, it's also, I mean, if you really look at this, sort of what my whole businessy thing is about now, what was Dell's competitive advantage? Was that customer service? It's the same parts. I mean, just throwing shit in a box in Singapore, wherever it gets made. You know, the thing that Dell had over other places was this human face on, or something you can call up and figure out.
You can get the exact Dell boxes from, like, the company that makes them for them for, like, it's the same thing, like, identical. Exact same box, you know. And
right, so you're buying an interface, you know, and you're buying some of that customer service. But, so when they outsource that, what's left? What is Dell then? You know, they're in their database file.
Tons of people call, it's crazy. Like, we would get, like,
old ladies,
yes. I got tons of old ladies. It was like their first computer.
Here? Yeah. And you like computers? You like computers?
It's sad, though. You know? Looking for just a voice in the night, and Larry King's not enough. Right? I'm convinced that Larry King is a bunch of old ladies. Okay, I said I would orient, and then we'll talk about Richard's concerns.
Look at the soapbox then?
No, I want to draw. I don't think drawing's going to matter, actually, but I will pretend it. Okay, so... this week and ending next week is sort of this the basic landscape of people manipulation. And what's interesting to me in terms of technology is the sort of the holy grail of how do we scale people manipulation. It's like the CIA interrogation manual kind of to me proves you get a person in a room and you've got enough good enough psychologists and good enough weapons and lighting and torture, you can get them to do what you want. You know, the trick is how do you get an entire society or a giant customer base to do what you want so you get rich. You know, and I used in the first class that example from the Star Wars movie, the entrainment of the Ewoks, because it's sort of a classic example of someone coming in and either telling a speech or using some technology or a little bit of both to sway an entire culture towards their agenda. You know, and that's gone on for a long, long time. You know, we watched that first documentary, which made it seem as if mass propaganda kind of began after Freud with guys like Bernays, who decided to use psychological techniques to reach the masses. But that's not really true. I mean, the Romans, and I talk about it in here, the Romans were doing that too, where you have this giant Roman game, and depending on whether you go thumbs up or thumbs down, or whether you have people get killed, or whatever you do, you can manipulate the crowd.
Isn't just culture in itself manipulation?
It is. The change that happened, and the reason I started the course there, is that in Roman games, and let's just think of it as, I think of it as the Colosseum, and these are all the people, and here's the lions and the killing and the blood. You treat them all as one thing, right? Everybody comes into the game, they all see the same thing, and bam. Then we had the Bernays period, where you still, so this is just the masses, right? The masses is just mass. Or even, I mean, where you get the word mass from, I believe, is Catholic mass. Right? It's this isn't against anybody's religion, but what Paul was trying to do was figure out how do we take something as abstract and strange and individualized that requires literacy, like Judaism, and how do we give that mass appeal? Well, the way we give it mass appeal is by creating a ritual that everyone can do, a good old-fashioned blood ritual like, you know, the wafer and the wine. It's like a sacrament. So it sort of for the mass, but it's a one-size-fits-all thing. Nuremberg rallies, again, it was still pre-Freud as far as Hitler was concerned, and it was dealing with this sort of everybody. Then along comes, you know, Freud and Bernays, and they still have the mass, but now they're looking at the mass as each of these people we're going to appeal to as individuals, right? So they're not talking to the thing anymore. Now, Bernays wants to talk somehow to each one. I mean, he's using still this sort of one-size-fits-all box, right? What does everyone want? Well, they all want their own house, their own car, their own beautiful wife, their own, you know, this is not my... So we're gonna give them this, you know, I mean, for me, the image would be sort of the little boxes on a hillside. You know, we're gonna treat the masses as this mass of individuals, as opposed to, say, the way Mao did it, or China did it, or the masses...
It's a divide and conquer.
Yeah, divide and conquer, right. Because when they're individuals, they're just gonna be there thinking that the other guy, you know, the other guy is happy. They're all looking at each other. It doesn't matter. See? But from the outside, they look happy to the other ones. So we had this, and then really right through much of coercion, we're looking at then how does technology, I mean, this was only possible because of technology and television and suburbs and all that. How do then, through technology, do we, rather than doing a one-size-fits-all thing to go to each person, you know, thanks to let's make this Bill Gates or something, if you want to call him our computer guy, that's a computer. You know, thanks to these, now we can tailor an individual message to each person. You know, there's a little section about Rap Collins in there, which was one of the first major direct marketing firms. You know, the way direct marketing used to happen was some guy, let's say he's a direct marketer in Memphis, Tennessee, he's got a bunch of card files. And it's like a card file on each family. It's got your address and anything they can find out about you on a physical card. Okay, they own a car, their real estate cost this much, they had a kid in this year, So then if you know, okay, now we want to get everybody who had kids in such and such a year because we want to send army propaganda to get them to join the army. So we want everyone born between, what would it be now, 1987 and 1994 or something, to get people who are going to be army age. Then you go through the cards, and they would go through manually, really, before they had databases and figure, okay, we can send this. Thanks to the computer now, we want to end up with a separate profile, which is CIA technique, a separate profile on every family, so then we can do a one-to-one marketing thing to it. And then after this is what people are misunderstanding, this is where I get interested, is rather than having a computer and having to hit every single family with individualized banner ads or whatever it is, you do this viral thing where you stick a virus into the organism and then have it infect all of your target cells. What most of the people who try to do viral marketing do is they just think, oh, viral marketing is a way for me not to have to broadcast. Viral is just a way for me to get people to do word of mouth and just spread my product by itself. But what viral marketing will eventually become, if people realize what it is, it's the other way to do this. And what everyone is looking for, what the supposed holy grail is a way to get the whole mass by appealing to them as individuals. I would argue the way to get the whole mass is actually to go back to the whole mass again and see the whole mass as an organism and figure out how you would get it to infect itself with something, which is sort of what happens. I mean, if you look at epidemics like suicide bombing, you know, that's not done through some kind of direct marketing. You know, that's done through a more organismic kind of stimulation.
I mean, you're getting people to do that?
You don't get people to do that. In other words, you don't have to get people to do it. In England, the British are still confounded by the idea that the people who did the subway bombings were British citizens. They're like, well, then how do we protect our borders? You know, they don't get that it's not about bad guys being told by someone on what to do and then sneaking into a country and blowing things up. That what we have is a mass media space through which ideas and even motivations can kind of spread more organismically. So that what you get is people within a country responding to something rather than, it's not following direct lines or direct command and control is what really happens.
I think one way of visualizing what happens is if they're infecting, they're not just infecting people with a virus, but the virus turns into a certain, the infected organism turns into a certain color if the virus hit it. So they'll go into these communities, talking about the bomb, the public domestic people to do this. They go into these communities and they throw these ideas out, and then they look very carefully to see who's being affected by these ideas, and they know that these are people that they could later on then treat as individuals and try to coerce them individually into doing these things.
Sometimes, although it can also happen, and that's when it's going to get really interesting, without any direct control. In other words, without the propagandist even noticing the individual and following up.
Someone would come to them, like the person would come.
You don't have to come to anyone. In other words, a kid in Akron, Ohio goes, suicide bombing, I get it, that's cool, I'm going to do it.
So this virus is pretending to be one of the common individuals. It's not the virus outside of the system. It's almost imitating the part.
It's organismic. It's organismic. It's sort of the way if you have a major plane crash. There will tend to be another major plane crash within a few weeks of that one. Because no other reason than that there's been one. And it's not the probability of clustering. It's that pilots will be more likely to do it when it's just happened, or suicides happen in clusters.
They're like, oh, it's okay for me to crash now because that guy did it last week.
Yes. Basically, yes.
What's the psychology of that?
Get the book called Influence by Cialdini. I mean, he talks about three or four different studies that were done about that. Suicides work that way?
It's not by direct contact, but
by media contact. In other words, if you have a suicide that's not talked about, it won't lead to a cluster of other suicides. If you have a famous suicide,
you'll see a big increase in the number of suicides after that. But the Kurt Cobain suicide leads to a big spike. And not just in, you know, Gen X grunge kids killing themselves because they're sad. It's because there's a major, suicide. Major car crashes, you know, lead to pileups in other areas too. And that's just because they just, I mean, maybe a pilot was going to crash anyway, but he's going to have that extra drink or be extra prone to it. Yeah.
Well, if I agree. I feel that the idea of a viral mechanism tends to be like most prevalent in the way things are spreading and like the way we begin to accept it, or everyone seems to know. Like your mom, when your mom says like "oh shizzle," you know, like it's not because they advertise it, because of this viral identity. But at the same time, don't you think that it could be remedied by the same way we literally fight a virus with a vaccination, like a very innocuous dose of something that's similar? So like suicide bombings would be remedied by a government with a very like innocuous version of what suicide bombers do, like talking about.
Well, either you do it from the outside, or I mean, that's, we're going to read the Introduction to Media Virus, where I look at just that, and I think of it as it's the underlying code that can't recognize. I mean, the reason viruses spread is because we don't recognize the protein in them as something other than us.
Right.
So when you get immune to it, it's because you start recognizing, oh, that's not me. You know, that's something that has to be got. Usually viruses spread because of a weakness in our own code. In other words, that there's something culturally that we're afraid to talk about.
Right.
So the Rodney King tape, which I see as the first great American media virus, this videotape spreads overnight for one reason, because it was a very unique, new, strange kind of media, and it keeps replicating because we were not having an open conversation about police brutality of black kids in
Los Angeles. If the open conversation had existed before, it would have acted as that vaccination.
As a vaccination, right. And until the conversation happens, the virus spreads and spreads and spreads and leads to urban rioting and all this stuff. Yeah.
But we're talking about a virus that is manipulated by the media, but what about human kind of virus, like the ones you're talking, the MTV parties or the iPod parties that they actually rent youth to go and promote their products? So, I mean,
right. These are all efforts at figuring out this new sort of hazy area. But I think that's, and we're going to talk about that. That's sort of where we're going with this, and we're looking at particularly how technology makes some of that possible that wasn't possible before.
So the virus then pretends to be one of us.
And they either work,
or
they don't work. You know, I'm still...
They don't work once you are aware of it, like anything. Like once you're aware to the media, once you're aware to the CIA interrogation.
Or sometimes they work anyway, in spite of the fact that we know. You know, so
right, that's the question.
Yeah. And that's what we're going to be looking at. You know, that's a big part of what we're going to look at. But I mean, this is just sort of where we get to by the end of next week. And I just wanted to show you why we used that documentary to start, was because what we were looking at was, I mean, we're looking at persuasion, we're looking at persuasion of individuals, but we're also looking at persuasion of groups. And at times they're looked at as the same thing. And if you have enough computers and enough people, they can be the same thing. You can communicate to all the masses one by one. It's called one-to-one marketing. What was that? Is that a Seth Godin book? One-to-one marketing and permission marketing and all this nonsense. Where if you know everything you need to know about a person, you create banner ads that you assemble in real time just for them, just to get you by what we know about you and what you've ordered. Your Amazon Gold box, which was assembled. Aren't those assembled just for you, or does everyone get the same damn one?
And the gold boxes.
You get personalized advertising. If you're in a Mac, you get a terminal Mac. If you're in a Mac, and
Gmail has, you know, they're working on sticking advertising in your mail that
relates to the keywords that they find in your communication. We'll see if it works or not. But, I mean, that's in a sense is another conversation for another day. I just wanted to get you kind of, to show you where, kind of how I was thinking about things. Then as we look at individual techniques, we're going to be looking at them both in terms of how they affect individuals and how they can affect larger groups. But I mean, what the second half of the coercion book, yeah.
Do you see this kind of state as something new, or was it also...
This thing?
The fact that
people are more, so are consciously exploiting it, I feel, is new. And I feel that the thing that makes it new is that we have a mass media that now connects all these people in a way, in a mass way that they weren't connected before. And a mass interactive media, really. I mean, because it used to be the only way you talk to all those people is through the TV set, right?
Before the TV set, I mean, I'm thinking again about the crusaders and, you know, like, this kind of, I mean, trying to spread concepts.
Word of mouth?
Yeah, physically.
I mean, they're definitely...
In a painful way. Like, be convinced or otherwise die.
Yeah, when you send an army out, it's kind of command and control, though.
But then you have, like, the Jesuits, who are all about spectacle. Much subtler kind of approach, and then they were there to save the Catholic Church from this like Protestant virus, right?
Even the drones in the church, you know, I mean, are they not marketing the stories we want to tell?
The Protestant thing was one of the first sort of media viruses, but
yeah.
You know that was because they had the printing press. That's how it started. It's your first mass media.
Well, it wasn't very mass at that point.
Well, minor mass media.
It's sort of a viral thing because it only hits this like educated elite who then have to propagate it out. Like, you know, the people with these weird books, you know, then have to teach all these other people how to be good Protestants.
Isn't that what the in the Bernays book or whatever is saying? That's where the roots of propaganda were. I think it was the Office of Propagation of the Faith, and. They were resisting the Protestant.
Yeah, I mean,
it's
like that's the Jesuits' like attempt. You know, it's the Catholic Church organized attempt to like convince people that they should stay in the Catholic Church. There's beautiful spectacles
right,
over here.
It's necessary.
Yeah, or maybe we'll torture you.
I guess.
We'll inquire.
I guess there have been lots of kind of like inseamed ways that culture and people have been influencing and asserting propaganda over other people, but honing in on, I guess you touched on it, but I'd like you to repeat it, because I'm not sure. What makes this, beyond the fact that we are in a media environment that we're not in, what makes this kind of viral communication different from anything historically?
I would think it's the amount of connections that we have to one another. So that historically, maybe you would interact with 8 people in a day. And it's really, I mean, it's only so far and fast things spread when towns are isolated from one another. I mean, when you have a mass media in America, even this mass media, it can get to the place that there's one thing going on.
I think it's like, I don't know if you've read Jared Diamond's like Guns, Germs, and Steel, but he has it's a thesis, it's a hypothesis, but his thing is that like, you know, when these Europeans went to America, they wiped out, you know, entire populations of natives with their diseases, but the native diseases didn't wipe out any Europeans, and the reason was that the Europeans lived in these cities where they created environments that were, like, where they got so close that new forms of viruses could mutate. They hit this sort of, like, point where, like, if you're stuck in a city together, like, a virus can then jump and evolve in this way that it couldn't if you lived in the plains of North America, you know, and there was an entire civilization and you know, like the Midwest basically that was gone. Like when I forgot who went all the way to Santa Fe, right?
But same thing happened with other stuff too,
yeah.
Though. I mean, that's one possible explanation, but then you look at why then when you bring European vegetation to Hawaii, does it wipe out, you know, all the, I guess partly the same reason that, you know,
in Hawaii, they quarantine animals.
Yeah.
If you have a cat and you bring it to Hawaii, it has just has to be quarantined for 6 months. And back and just like constantly be exposed to these shots.
That's
so
cool.
Yeah, like, yeah, they actually have very strict rules about livestock.
Because they lost, I mean, it was very slow for Hawaii to get vegetation. It's like one plant every 100,000 years. Some bird or whatever or something would wash up on shore and you'd get a new kind of tree. And the Europeans came, and it was really like 50 years or 100 years, like 90% of vegetation was wiped out. It's a couple little preserves. Right, because the Polynesians came first and brought their stuff, which was stronger, and then...
Well, we got the those like snakehead fishes in Queens now, right?
Yeah. That's besides the point, though. That are coursing the other fish. This is horrible fish. They'll bite and kill. Eat everything else. So it's all over. The hurricane's bad.
Well, it just seems like the point is that the viral side has always been around, but it's the viral in addition to the mass media that's the change, because you can get a message in and then you have your own personal network, and if there's now a medium that's two ways, then I'll take a mass media message and maybe I'll turn that into a personal network message, and then that infects somebody else's personal network, and that's the thing that moves so quickly, doesn't it?
Yeah, but the question then becomes, In Bernays' day, in order to spread a message on a mass level, you had to have a newspaper or a TV station or a radio station. You had to basically be FDR, Hitler, William Randolph Hearst, Rupert Murdoch. Do you still, and we're going to evaluate this, do you still need to have great power and great money to have great influence and great persuasion in a highly technologized universe? Some would argue, yes, even more so, because now you have to know more about people, you've got to have more records, you've got to have access to PRISM and Axiom and Claritas and all the databases so that you can get through and figure out who they are, and it's all the harder and all the more expensive. You've got to be able to buy time on Sex and the City with a fake set of ads for, you know, Absolute Vodka. You've got to have more influence. Or you can argue the opposite, and no, you just have to be clever. You know, you're one of your move on, you know, Ellie Parisi, who was nobody, start something which is a major political movement. But then again, is he winning any elections? You know? Is there any move on candidates actually doing well, or is it just an exhaust for effort that might better be spent in more mainstream political pursuits? We'll see. But this is just a sort of map, and people, I mean, I'll claim to understand this, but in reality, nobody really understands quite how this works, and they don't know whether to be threatened by...
It's like a water cooler, water coolers every office in the city.
That's one way of understanding it.
But I think returning to Diamond, and again, it is just a hypothesis, but like what's interesting is that, you know, our media is now getting faster and cheaper, which ties us information-wise closer together, so you have almost a... Instead of an information countryside, you have an information city developing, which allows new, like, a different form of propagation. And you can, like, viruses just don't really spread in rural communities. Like, very occasionally they might, but, like, it doesn't happen.
Well, they can now.
Well, now if you have the, you know, the farmers flying into, you know.
Well, if the farmer's got an AOL connection or something.
Oh, well, media virus. No, but I mean like a physical virus. Like the odds of you catching the cold that everybody at ITP has if you're out on a farm in Delaware or somewhere else.
Social viruses. That's like, what I'm
talking about.
Yeah.
Smoking crystal meth. Like,
yeah.
That's spreading from the countryside.
Oh, that's exactly what...
Crank, or there's another one.
It's crystal meth.
It's crystal meth.
Is it?
Yeah.
Why is it called crystal?
Because
the
price is different.
Well, they have to rebrand the thing every couple of years, you know?
Rebrand it, right.
But, I think that's the
crystal
point.
Crystal meth used to be basically freebase when I was a kid. That's what we called it. And it's the same thing, too, really.
Well, this is not cocaine.
No.
What's your freebase?
Freebase is a technique, so you can freebase cocaine, you can freebase speed, too.
It feels the same.
It's also coke that's been alkalized, and so it's called it.
It's run by
Cody. We're going to ask Tom. It'll be the final certification in the lab there.
Is that what he's doing? The door's closed?
To use ether and evaporation. All right, so let's talk a little bit about group stuff and then take our break. You want to help us?
Well,
yeah.
Actually, I'm going to probably relate directly to this. I think a lot of what the second half of Thorsen was dealing with was really kind of, you know, we become more media literate, so it's more about selling the ad than the product itself. We're selling, you know, the group that you're in. One of the very interesting things I found about the book, and I'm going to pose this question to everybody, it kind of relates to this, I think, in a way, is that the idea of a target audience, a target market, you know, how does that apply with what we've got up here? Is it fair enough to say that, you know, consumers can be categorized into a particular group? Is it cost effective for you know, agencies to try and categorize to each one of us, or is it better off that they just get all the data and then say, okay, everybody's part of this demographic or this, you know, geographic area, et cetera? Or would it be more effective for advertisers to be using like psychographics where they're not trying to categorize things, but they're trying to, you know, touch upon some base that every human being kind of shares? And I'm guessing that a media virus would have to follow along that, you know, because a virus by itself, I don't think it's targeting anyone in particular. Some people are more susceptible to it. I guess you could.
I mean, it's weird. They made the Honda Prelude car, the first sort of Honda sports car, thinking that like young men would want it, and it turned out to be like middle-aged women loved it. It was like this weird. It was super successful, but it was this total flip on what they thought.
Or what about Coke Zero? You guys seen Coke Zero? I didn't know what it was. Like,
well, there's Coke Zero, there's Coke Two.
Well, Coke Zero is like the newest one.
Heard Six is better.
No, it's not the Splenda Coke. It's different. There's Diet Coke and Splenda, and then there's this Coke Zero. And I just happened to be out with a friend of mine, and she ran into this woman who she knew or whatever, and it turns out she's the brand manager for Coke Zero.
No, Coke Two is that.
And it was bothering me. I'm like, what is Coke Zero? So I'm like, you probably don't want to talk about work, but I'm really confused. I don't understand what Coke Zero
is. You are so in the real problem.
And she said, because it's not really for you. Coke Zero is for young men. It's like Diet Coke, but it tastes different, and it's for young men. And I was like, oh, okay, but
it's okay that you don't know, because you're not in our target market.
See, this is exactly,
yeah.
Like,
Yeah.
I've worked with ad agencies where you'll get a packet, and it's like, okay, we're trying to sell a product. Here's our demographic, and this is what they do, and this is who they are, and, you know. A lot of the times, it's people around our age, because, you know, some people are
not
slightly younger.
To our things yet.
Yeah, we haven't developed a relationship with a brand. We're not sold on the brand. We don't buy the same toothpaste every time we experiment because maybe there's something cheaper or better out there. Plus, we have a disposable income, you know. So, and when I read these types of things, I'm like, this is just bullshit. It's like half of it, you know, it's very extremely vague. You know, it's almost like a propaganda machine. And like you were saying with the Prelude, like the Coke, did you try Coke Zero?
I think I accidentally bought it because it looked so much like Diet Coke.
Did it
taste
like a man's drink?
Did it taste like one?
I mean,
so
but I already know in this room knows what Coke Zero is. I'm probably the expert.
Isn't it Coke for losers?
No, it's actually Coke 2 and Coke Zero are both considered conventional wisdom that these are big problems for Coke, because what they've done is undermine Diet Coke business, which was really a big, big deal. And now people can't figure out what's the sort of.
Yeah.
But Coke, the other thing about Coke is like, what is it, 3/4 or more of their business is overseas anyway? It's like they just fuck up their American market.
Well,
and it doesn't hurt them that bad.
It's kind of proven in advertising a lot of times that when you create a brand, you this is from that Hero and the Outlaw book, which I don't know if you ever ended up reading, but the theory is that, like, you know, advertise or brands can either relate to like the young archetypes that everybody's associated with, or they, you know, embody an archetype themselves. But you don't see brands jumping, you know, their demographic in a way. You can't like take the Phaeton, for instance. You guys familiar with that? The VW car, like the $90,000 or $110,000 Volkswagen.
That was the deluxe Volkswagen.
Yeah, it's like
it is.
Got great reviews. Was a great car. Didn't sell so well. Why not?
bird can't change its feathers or stripes or something.
Exactly. Right? And the same thing with, like, I think New Pepsi or what was it? You know.
So what about Cadillac? Cadillac moved from old guy in Arizona with plaid pants to acceptable to be shown in hip hop video.
Oh, that's not true though.
It was a pimp car.
Yes and no.
Yeah.
Yes and no. You gotta look at the underlying. Go back to Jung now. What's the underlying symbol of a Cadillac? Who was that guy with the plaid pants? He was an immigrant coming to America, wanting to achieve the American dream. Little Sal with his pizza parlor, but he opens his third pizza parlor and he gets the Cadillac. Right? So who was the next ethnic racial group that needed that acceptance? It was Jews. And Jews started getting all those Cadillacs, and they were driving around, you know, Morris with his landscaping business and Seymour with his, you know, pinball company. I got my Cadillac, Sammy. Yes, Morris, it's beautiful. Right? And then what was the next group? Blacks, right? So you find the first up-and-coming young black generation then goes and buys a Cadillac. Then again, the only Cadillac brand that's working is the Escalade, however you say it. It's saving their focus now. And the Escalade is just a, what's the other one? It's a
Tahoe, right? Or something.
It's a what?
Isn't it like a Tahoe? It's just the rebranded Tahoe.
I think Cadillac's lost. I mean, they originally represented, like, you know, the someone with higher income, you know, was proud to be in America type of thing. But now you see it, like, the advertising has Led Zeppelin on it. They're trying to appeal to a youth audience. But then you're talking about putting it in a hip hop video, which
that's
is
for
like
old
a totally,
music.
I would almost consider it a totally different demographic.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, it's not about youth, though. It's about people who are.
Yeah. How is Led Zeppelin like for youth?
Well, it
actually
ruins the song for me, regardless.
It's worked, it's hurt a bunch of, it's hurt Jimmy Page in my mind. But Oldsmobile failed with that. They had this campaign, because only old guys are buying Oldsmobiles, so they started to say, it's not your father's Oldsmobile. It was this really famous campaign, and drove Oldsmobile. They're gone. You know, and then what Doers did, Doers Scotch, I noticed in the Subway's computer, but they did the opposite. They said, okay, this is associated with older people, so why don't we make it a badge of having gotten old? You know, so they have these, not old guys, but they have guys in their 20s and 30s who now have the symbol of, you know, oh, there's a naked girl in your apartment, it's time for Doers. You know, that you're now of the age where you can do this thing. But yeah, these are about brands, they're not even about attributes. I mean, it's one thing when you're talking about targeting. If they know, oh, Richard's thinking of changing your toothpaste this week, let's bombard him. Come on! You know, they send all the first things and get you. They figured out. You know, that's one thing. It's another to be like, oh, your, you know, loyalty to the idea behind Volkswagen is wavering. That's weird. And that's a harder, it's more ethereal. But it's their realm, I guess.
Yeah, I'm gonna still talk about Brian, but
if he wants to, you love it.
Were you gonna say something? You look like you were.
What do you want to talk about?
I don't know. No, there's a lot of stuff on brands. I just, is that where we're keeping it? Or are we gonna?
No, we can move on if you want.
I do want to make sure we talk about some of this cult and pyramid stuff, this sort of group pressures, you know, which can be powerful, you know. I mean, gosh, those students here are still steeped in weird ass shit. I mean, there's cult qualities to ITP.
I think it's students
that are steeped in weird ass shit.
You know, like weird culty religions and
like Landmark.
You know, bizarre repetitive seminars and expensive mind systems.
I found it to be a little bit of a jump going from. I mean, it's the book's titled Coercion, so obviously, you know, it's a form of coercion.
Yeah.
But I almost felt like the entire first portion of the book had to deal with advertising or selling something, whether it be person to person or using some other method of propaganda to get it across. And then all of a sudden, kind of jumps. It's almost like this is a total. It almost seemed like it was a different subject. Something that
cults.
I think all of us. Yes, cults, pyramid schemes, Ponzi schemes. I think it's something
except
that we all relate
to. Except for the fact that cult branding, cult advertising is the hottest, biggest name.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask.
Is Macintosh not a college?
Well, that's what I wanted to ask is, can people think of examples where this is prominent? Because I almost think that a lot of advertising company or advertising and brands they're cautious about it because it almost has like a bad reputation. It's got kind of like the smiley, upfront face of it, like take Market America for instance, Anybody familiar with that?
No.
Really? It's pretty much a pyramid scheme.
Yeah.
It's not an Amway.
No. It's just another one of them, right?
It's just another one, yeah. And what's that?
Market America.
Yeah.
It's like Amway.
I'm just waiting for somebody to say, no, it's not, stand up and... But, yeah, it's a basic system where and this isn't the first time I've run across it. It's similar to Mary Kay and, the kitchen shop, I think it is. Or, basically it's like, okay, let's bring the malls to people instead of selling it, going into a literal mall. You can purchase it from the next person. You can even... I thought it was funny because I went to their website, and they don't sell any products on their website, but they can sell people to sell... To buy stores to sell products via a website, but I mean it's the same kind of
stuff. They can sell people to buy stores.
Mary Kay is not about buying products; it's about buying the opportunity to sell products.
It's about finding the
cares
people
about
to distribute.
Mary Kay, let's say they want to be the Mary Kay that sells things.
They want to be Cadillac.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What you do is you buy the right to sell their products. And usually you don't buy it directly from them, you buy it from someone else. So if I'm a Mary Kay distributor, I'm then supposed to get my friends and family to become Mary Kay distributors underneath me, and so on.
There's...
Huh? I think, can I?
It's kind of like, it taps into the whole, the more ignorant idea of American capitalism, you can just go and have people working for you and make money. This is a really easy way for you to be a boss, essentially, because you're a distributor and you have a boss, but then anyone else that works under you, you're getting a cut from them. So it seems like the...
It seems like it's supposed to get
American
free money, right? Yeah.
It's just like,
it's the promise of free money.
Yeah.
It's like everyone else to do the work and you're just the one...
And people who are successful in it are the people who read, understand, and are good at performing the persuasion techniques on individuals in their social or community circle.
The other thing I'm kind of surprised about is that, I'm jumping a little bit here, but, you talk about email and spam campaigns, and, I can see in, 1999, it's today it's that's pretty common knowledge, but then back then it was a lot different, the idea of, somebody's home address or what seems like a home address selling us something, and we've become so, I think it's culturally kind of just gotten so immune to it that, I go to my inbox and I just know what to delete when it's there. And I'm surprised that systems like Market America or like Mary Kay or, they still exist, and there's still there's still people that are buying into this thing. In the book it talks about how, usually they find these, the people that get sucked into them find these opportunities by chance. But it's not by a direct route, It's almost like, I almost think that the major brands and markets and advertising have almost kind of gained our trust in that fact. Because of, it's almost like a reversal of things. Like you would trust, when you go to the store, you might trust a brand name that you see over a generic brand. Because it's been around for so long. I think New York's a perfect example of that because you go through, I see a bakery that's been around since the 1890s. I'm like, well, they're doing something right. They've been around that long, And so I almost think the same way with brands.
What about when you see the bakery that pretends they've been around since 1890?
Looks like they haven't renovated since 1890. Those stocks,
A while ago, I went to, that was in 2000, and I was definitely watching what was going on in the internet, boom, and all that, because it was not doing anything. That was super 8 months. And it was interesting to, I signed up to, one of my roommates, he was in the internet, then he was a programmer. So he signed me up with Bernardo's List. I don't know if you've heard about it.
What?
Bernardo's List.
Bernardo's List.
It's that list of events, and it was like networking and all this. And I would go to a few to see what people were talking about, what they were doing, what they were up to. And also, it was for me, it was an opportunity to go to different places to see lounges and bars. So that was also interesting, the architecture of that and how they... the social interaction between these places, and actually having to run into a guy who's an architect who was doing the same thing as like watching how people behave in bars and in lounges and all that. So anyway, it was one of these events that this woman was inviting people to meet to learn about a new business opportunity. So she used to like, it was asking you to go to a specific address in 6th Avenue. So I went, and I ran into a woman, and we started talking because we were working. We started talking like, this is such a scam. Like, yeah, it is. Let's see what it is. Because the woman was like, oh, well, you know, why did a lot of people sign up? So it's like, the conference room is not big enough, so we're going to go somewhere else. Like, yeah, right. So we went. It was in the, I think it was the Marquise on Times Square. And they had like this huge ballroom filled with chairs and like half with people. Like, yeah, right. This is like an impromptu meeting in this room. And it was one of these schemes of pyramid stuff. And the people that were in front, they were like all these white guys from the Midwest. We heard them speak of the ones like they are from Utah. And it's like they're probably Mormons. And then all the people sitting there were all immigrants, like Hispanics, Blacks, or Asians. The largest group was Hispanic, and then African Americans, and then Asians. But it was like, it was so painful, we left. Because it was like, it's incredible, they can do this, and people just fall immediately, just like that.
It's not that they don't fold.
Like hats and t-shirts and all this to get the people to sign up. So
It's just like I went to like a, like when I first graduated college and I was like answering ads. I went to like one of these pyramid things. I didn't know it was a pyramid thing. I was just answering. You know, I'm sure it was, I forgot what the ad was, but I'm sure it was totally misleading. And you get in there and they show you these videos and then they like keep, you know, it's just trying to sell you their vitamins, whatever the hell it was, right?
Well, usually now they're selling you just to sell other people nothing. In other words, you sell information. And the information that you're selling is not someone else who can sell information.
Yeah, they wanted to sell
it. Website and sell.
But the thing, like, they were like, but they needed to sell. You know, a lot of these people were low. You know, they have their hierarchy, so they have to sell a vitamin too. You know, like buy a sample. It's like, why can't you give me a free sample? Well, you got to buy a sample, right? It's like, and then
there are other ones too that are pure cash. They can contact people and do some grants that we're talking about. It was this whole like women empowerment. It's like, it's literally just money. Like, you're just supposed to donate money because you're lending to this pool of other women who want to empower other women.
And then eventually you move up the tree.
You move up the tree and you get the cash. And the thing that sucked this friend of mine in was this idea that, you know, for her it was okay to go through and try and do something like that. Because what you'd actually do is that when you get to the top of the pyramid was that, you know, take a bunch of that and just still kick it back in anyways. Because you didn't really need all of that, but just a little bit of it. So that was like a thing that like worked out okay or justified it okay in her mind. Just that, you know, I'll do this and I'll get other people in, but I'm not really actually even going to take all of the profit. It's really just people.
Yeah.
Zero profit.
Oh, I'd almost argue that I guess, now they've got to thinking about, probably these pyramid schemes, what's kept them around, I almost think they're using more like psychographics, because one thing, if you ever talk to people who are involved with these schemes, if particularly the ones that are in early, is they exude confidence, you know, and it's kind of like it's empowering, and it's something that, you know, that sense is something that is a, you know, is a human characteristic that can apply to all of us. But I don't think a pyramid scheme could go out to find a target audience other than that, you know, and say, okay, well, this is who we're going to hit. You know, we're going to try and advertise these particular people and try and get them into our program. Instead, it's the people that are looking for comments or just looking to make an extra buck or whatever.
Working in a more viral way.
Exactly, yeah.
It's looking for people who have that weakness and they're going to spread and find the others.
I don't even know. I mean, it's also just basic. It's a job, you know? Still
at the end of the day, it's also just like there's some people who want to make money.
It's
and
a
not
sales job,
you
know?
They even need confidence or not, but to make more money, you have to exude that confidence. It might be an after effect, right? I think the pyramid schemes are just out there. You know, a lot of this stuff just...
See, what's not a pyramid scheme, frankly? You know, in terms of American business and the way our money is created and the fiduciary money by fiat, I mean, it all is that in one way or another. And that's what Amway's trying to say. This is the American way. This is how it works. There are going to be winners and losers. Bankruptcy is built into the system. So, you want to win?
Now, if you want to win, then you better learn how to play that game.
There is a big difference between a transaction where you're like, okay, I'm selling you a computer, and you get a computer, and I get, like, you know, $2,000 or whatever. Versus, like, oh, I'll sell you a computer, and then you're going to sell a computer to somebody else who'll sell, you know, it's a very different exchange.
Yeah, I'm going to sell you a computer so that you can do something on that computer to sell that other thing to someone else. I mean, it's still going to transact with it. But yeah, it's certainly not as blatant. The investment community is just that, though. When you invest in a stock, really, you're just trying to, it's horse racing. You're making money off the someone who's lost money on that stock. You're not making money off the company.
Well, there's dividends.
On some stocks,
Real estate.
Yeah.
I mean, I keep watching them put up these buildings, and I see the prices they're charging for them, and I'm like, man, it's very soon they're not going to be enough people who can afford a $2 million apartment to buy all this.
No, and that's a group thing that is sort of the last thing I want to make sure we touch on before we break, is for the real estate boom to happen, there has to be this kind of mass hysteria, this mass group idea that, oh, it's going up, it's going to keep going up, if I don't buy now, I'm never going to be able to get anything. I mean, there's an insanity. And how does that insanity happen? I would argue it goes back to preparing the field and having total control over the environment. When you have total control over the environment, then you can dictate the reality, whether you're doing it for one person sitting alone in a box, whether you're doing it for a group of people at the Nuremberg rallies or at what were those ones called, the Promise Keepers or a Farrakhan rally or a big football game that you can sort of create the values, or if you're really good at it, you do it out in the real world, you know, where you can create a culture in New York where people buy into some essentially fabricated reality. For example.
Yeah. I mean, what was the origin of that? It was like in the 1700s or
1800s? In Holland.
In Holland.
Rare,
crazy.
It wasn't
the
first.
Tulip mania?
Tulips. They started investing crazy in tulips.
Yeah, there'd be people develop rare tulips, and there'd be like a black tulip, and there's something like tulips have a half-life. When you develop one, like, it starts to fade. It's the way they breed, so like, you can, there's like the black tulip that they had was about to die out, and you couldn't, you know, you got to find another black tulip, and it goes for like however many guilders, you know, whatever they.
But it is interesting. Truth. I mean, the power of nightmares that we'll look at after the persuaders is sort of about that. It's looking at the idea of total control, you know, over an environment. How do you get to the place, you know, how did, you know, and I think fear and aggression is a big one. You know, when 9/11 happens, you've got an opportunity for that kind of mass control. You know, that's when your control over the playing field and the information environment becomes so total, even for a short period of time, that you can really affect things just like an interrogator. I mean, you when the whole thing is your canvas, it's. Virus. In other words, and until they deal with that corrupt code, which is in there now, that corrupt cultural code, the virus is going to be able to keep interpolating in there. I mean, it's just like the AIDS virus in America. Part of the reason why it spread for so long, which is Larry Kramer's brilliance, was that America wasn't ready to deal with it, but what's really going on here? Not that we are yet, but still. Okay, so go away, but come back. And what? Do we give a full 15? If I say that, I'll say 10 so that I can hear it.